think a good exhibition should pose a question, and then it should bring together a number of voices, if it's a group show, mm-hmm. that provide different answers to that question. And maybe not definitive answers, but just different avenues for considering it and what the possibilities are.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Isaac Butler.
And I'm your other host, June Thomas.
June, I feel like it's been a while. I've been recording with Ronald. You've been recording with Ronald. This is our first episode recording together in quite some time. How have you been?
Well, I feel the same way. I've been missing you. I've been well, though I would surely have been even better if I'd seen more of you, Isaac. I missed
Aww,
you.
Aw, thank you. Who do we have on the show this week?
Well, the voice we heard at the top of the show belongs to Courtney Gilbert. She is the curator of the Sun Valley Museum of Art, which is based in Ketchum, Idaho. And I spoke with Courtney for a piece I was reporting for the New York Times Tea magazine about how the way that pop culture treats aliens is changing. And usually those kinds of conversations are pretty focused. You're looking for insight, hopefully a quote that pops. But I found myself asking Courtney questions about the museum and the way she works there. You know, we were talking for a long time after I'd kind of gotten the thing I needed for the piece. So I figured that listeners would also be interested in learning about a small non-collecting museum in the Mountain West.
Amazing. You really buried the lead there. This is a good reminder for our listeners that June's piece about aliens and popular culture was published a while ago. You can go look it up on the New York Times website. We'll put it on the show notes for this. But let's set that aside for a moment and talk about what's most important. What have you got for our Slate Plus listeners?
Well, I asked Courtney how she got into curation. Her PhD is in art history rather than museum studies or anything along those lines. So I asked her to tell me about her career path from the very specialized world of scholarship to the breadth that is required to be a curator.
Well, that is amazing. I can't wait to listen to it. And if, like me, you are a Slate Plus member, that will be waiting for you at the end of this episode. If you're not a Slate Plus subscriber, at this point, I'm wondering what you're waiting for. You know, you go to slate.com/workingplus today, you spend a little money, and you get all these goodies. You get full access behind the paywall at our mothership site. You get bonus segments on shows like this one. You get bonus full episodes of shows like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, and you get to sleep easy at night knowing that you've done everything you can to support what we do right here on Working. Go to slate.com/workingplus today to sign up. All right, now let's listen in to June's interview with curator Courtney Gilbert.
Courtney Gilbert, welcome to Working.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I wanted to talk with you today because you are the curator of the Sun Valley Museum of Art in Ketchum, Idaho. And I have to admit that the purpose of my questions is to help me figure out what a curator does, because something tells me it's a job made up of a lot of different components. So let's start with a museum. What's special about the Sun Valley Museum of Art?
Yeah, well, that is very true. Being a curator means a lot of different things, and I think it's really different at each institution. Hmm. We are a small museum. We're non-collecting, which is not necessarily unusual, but it does differentiate us, I think, from a lot of other institutions. We borrow everything that we show. We curate almost all of our exhibitions in-house, and I often get the chance to work with artists to commission new work for exhibitions, which is, I think, one of my favorite parts of my job. But you know, I do everything from contacting artists and starting the process of inviting them here and hosting them when they're here, if they're doing a project for us, to serving as the registrar for our exhibitions. I write condition reports when artwork comes in. I also regularly install artwork. I've learned a lot about power tools and filling holes in walls that, you know, we did not go over in graduate school. I've developed a whole new set of skills. So the other thing that's unusual about us, I think, is our place. We're located in a small community in the Intermountain West. It's primarily a resort community. So it's a place that people come often more for recreation than for anything else. And I think a lot of visitors here are surprised when they get here at by sort of the amazing array of cultural activities in this valley. There are a lot of organizations doing really good work here, whether that's in the performing arts or culture lecture series. So, yeah, and so I really try to respond to this place as much as I can in the work that I do.
Wow. Okay, so you mentioned that you're not a collecting museum. So what's behind that decision, and how does that affect the process of curation? I mean, you're basically starting from scratch every time you mount an exhibition, right?
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. So I think it's embedded in our history more than anything else. We were founded as the Sun Valley Center for the Arts just over 50 years ago in 1971. And originally, the center was more of a teaching institution than anything else. People would come here for the summer to take classes with teachers who were, you know, nationally known artists in photography, ceramics, printmaking. There were also painting classes and weaving classes. So it was, there were exhibitions that took place, but they were often of student work or, you know, small exhibitions by the people who taught here. And sort of as the area grew up, and one of the inevitable things that happened was that it became very difficult for young people who were interested in studying photography or ceramics to find housing here in the summer. The model shifted more to an exhibiting institution. And the center actually in the 80s and 90s ran a commercial gallery and sold some of the artwork that they showed. Yeah, so it's very much evolved. And then in... Yeah. And we've also moved locations multiple times and never had the kind of access to storage facilities that a collecting museum would need. And it was never an institutional priority either.
Yeah.
So we've stuck with that model. And I love it because it means we're always showing things that are new. Mm-hmm. We have a small space anyways. Our exhibition space is 2,200 square feet. So...
Does that compare with one of a famous museum? Do you have a point of comparison?
Well, the only specific point of comparison I have is before I moved here, I worked for the Blanton Museum at University of Texas, and they were in the process of building a brand new building, which is spectacular and was finished shortly before I left. And I think they have 40,000 square feet just of exhibition space. Yeah,
so exhibition space. Okay. And who... Like, where does the financing come from?
So one of the other things that's unusual about us is that we host a wine auction every summer. And that wine auction was started in 1981. It's an event that draws people from all over, particularly from California, Washington State, Oregon. And that generates about 40% of our annual operating budget. Yeah, it's an extraordinary multi-day event. So we're really lucky to have that to fall back on. And then I've spent much of this week writing grant proposals. We're always seeking funding from all kinds of both private foundations and government agencies. And then we have a really strong membership base and a strong group of private donors who are very generous and have supported the work that we do over the years.
Okay. So my familiarity is quite recent, which, you know, is on me. But I noticed that you seem to have very strong thematic exhibitions. And I guess maybe by not being a collecting museum, you never get to just say, oh, just check out the permanent collection right now. We'll do another focus show soon. I mean, when you're between thematic exhibitions, are you ever between, or do you just kind of go from one exhibition to another? Because you can't ever just fall on the permanent collection, right?
Right. No, absolutely. So we do tend to go from one thematic show to the next. You and I first were connected when I had just mounted an exhibition about called Sightings that was a look at kind of our human relationship to the possibility of extraterrestrial life and why do we look at the night skies and how do we process things we can't understand? Why are we interested in the possibility of UFOs and extraterrestrials, which was really, it was a show that I, you know, to be candid, I think some of my colleagues were skeptical about why I was working on this topic. But I really, for me, it was, I was particularly inspired by the fact that sightings, the number of sightings went up by something like 30% during the pandemic. And that was really fascinating to me. I felt like people were looking for a reason and feeling isolated. So, yeah. So, and right now we have an exhibition about the relationship between art and healing that includes work by six contemporary artists, four of whom have kind of used their practices as a way of navigating what it is to be a patient and what it is to face serious illness and to go through treatment. So the next exhibition I'm doing is actually, it's a smaller show. It's two artists and one artist collective who all use weaving and also other craft-based materials like ceramics as platforms for activism and for advocating for social change. Yeah, so things, I always try to, you know, as I look at a calendar year, we sort of try to strike a balance in terms of the topics and themes. We always try to connect them in some way to this place.
Mm-hmm. So what's your process for deciding on exhibitions? I mean, those are all pretty high concept shows, which I, you know, I mean in a very positive way. Like, how do you come up with them?
Well, there are a few things that happen that kind of lead me to a topic. And the first is that I have great colleagues. I'm the only full-time curator, but we have a wonderful curatorial assistant. I have a great colleague in public programs and an amazing director of learning and engagement and other programming colleagues. And we sit down together once a month to talk about ideas and things we're interested in and share what we're interested in pursuing. So I'll often, you know, introduce an idea at one of those meetings and sort of use that as a way to gauge whether it's going anywhere. And then the second thing that happens, and this is actually probably how most shows start because I've seen the work of an artist either in an exhibition or read about it or seen it online that triggers an idea or that makes me want to work with that artist and figure out a way to make that happen. So that's definitely the case for the last, I mean, I think that's the case for almost every show I've ever worked on.
I was wondering about that. I was wondering, like, what came first, the concept that you thought would be generative in terms of like, okay, I know artists who will have ideas about this or just a specific piece?
It's a little bit of both, but typically it'll start with the artist and the artwork. And I think more and more that is the direction I'm working in. And I'm also more interested lately in saying to an artist or several artists, what are you interested in doing? So I'm excited about the possibility of doing more solo exhibitions or just two-person exhibitions and giving artists the opportunity to execute a project that they have been wanting to do and give them the support to make that happen, which we already do that with our commission projects, but I think they have tended to be in response to an idea that I'm asking. Yeah, like in the sightings exhibition, Deb Sokolo created this just unbelievably wonderful artist book and series of drawings around local lore about UFOs in our valley. And, you know, I think she really enjoyed working on the project and I loved working with her, but it was her responding to me saying, are you interested in UFOs?
Yeah.
Do you want to come here?
Yeah.
We'll be back with more of June's conversation with Courtney Gilbert after this. Hey, listeners, Isaac Butler here. I just wanted to quickly say, if you're listening to this episode and you're enjoying it, why not click follow on your podcast app so that you will never miss an episode of Working? Hey, you already follow us, or as the kids used to call it, subscribe? Then you're wondering what more you could do? Well, you could review us. You could rate us. Each app has a little bit of a different way to do this. On Overcast, it's a star. On Apple, of course, it's a 1-to-5-star system or whatever. But these little things actually really help us escape the churning whirlpool of the podcast algorithm and find new listeners. So if you could go ahead and do that, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you in advance. Okay, now back to June's conversation with curator Courtney Gilbert.
So you've said you sometimes will see a work of art and mm-hmm. you're kind of almost inspired to try to work with that artist. But how do you decide which artists, you know, whose work is going to be part of an exhibition? Are you typically calling on your Rolodex of artists? And does your Rolodex or whatever the contemporary equivalent is note things like, he'll be good on aliens, or her work often deals with the body? I know you said you're maybe changing, but like, can you say a little more about how you kind of figure that out?
Yeah. So first of all, I think a good exhibition should pose a question, and then it should bring together a number of voices, if it's a group show, mm-hmm. that provide different answers to that question and different ways of thinking about the question. And maybe not definitive answers, but just different avenues for considering it and what the possibilities are. And I also think of a good exhibition a little bit as a story. It sort of has a narrative. Not that it's going to hit viewers over the head with, you know, this is the beginning and the middle and the end, but a little, you know, that they can tie together a few voices and pull out some narrative threads after seeing it. And then, so the artists need to kind of make sense in conversation with each other. Mm-hmm. The work has to be in conversation. Yeah, and I have a lot of different systems. It's funny, the different systems I've had over the years for that Rolodex. It used to be, you know, frantically printing out. I went through so much paper. Anytime I got an exhibition announcement that looked interesting or received, you know, a postcard or found an article online, I'd print the whole thing out and put it in a folder. And these folders would have themes just written on them. And some of them turned into exhibitions and some of them didn't. I still have some that from probably 2007 that I'm actually looking at again, you know. So that was like the 2000s. And then I became a little bit more, I wouldn't say disorganized, but looser about it. And I used to have these little white pieces of paper that I would write artist names on and an idea and then a question mark. And they were just... My desk is just, it's an embarrassment. And they would pile up all these little white pieces of paper, and sometimes they'd emerge from a pile. And I'd think, oh my gosh, these two things go together, you know?
See, that's the dream, right? I mean, connecting the dots, you got to put the dots out there first.
Yeah, exactly. And now, you know, I actually use Pinterest a lot. I don't do research on Pinterest. I use Pinterest, and I'm sure there are many types of software or platforms you could use to do this. But I just have secret boards. I've, you know, maybe 30 secret boards with thematic ideas. And anytime I see an artist whose work is of interest, I'll save some to that board or create a new board. I'm not a Pinterest person. I don't share anything or look to it for inspiration, but I find it very useful as an organizing tool.
Yeah. Wow. That is fascinating. Is there any kind of audition process for commissions?
No. It's just, it's always done by invitation, and usually by the time I've reached out to somebody, I'm pretty positive I'd love to work with them. I mean, there have been people I've talked to over the years who haven't wound up doing a project, but usually that has to do with logistics, you know, more than anything else. But I do like bringing people here for sort of extended site visits so they can get a sense of who we are and of this place.
And how long would that be? A week?
Yeah, it's been anywhere from a week to, I have an artist arriving tomorrow who she will be here for 3 weeks, just kind of getting to know the community. And then she'll come back actually next summer and lead some workshops. I'm doing a series of exhibitions around the idea of migrations.
Ooh.
And I'm co-curating one of the shows, and then one of the shows is being entirely curated by a young curator from Arizona named Aaron Joyce, who's really fantastic. And Aaron, you know, Aaron's of a different generation than I am, and it's the first time I've worked with a guest curator, and it's really energizing in a way, and I'm excited about the prospect of increasingly bringing outside curators here, maybe once a year, to create a show for us. Because I do feel, I've been here a really long time, and I don't think it's necessarily a good thing for an institution to have the same person creating the stories that it tells forever.
Well, there are definite advantages, right? I mean, you're very well connected, you all of those things, but then, you know, bringing in new blood, but also maintaining the consistency, that feels like a wonderful solution. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's so funny how I've noticed that, you know, often on our object labels, we'll put the birth year of the artist, and that birth year often is not that far off of mine. I also don't think that's such a good thing. I think it's good to bring in lots of different generations together.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, I don't want to get too hung up on the non-collecting part, but something that strikes me is kind of once you commission an artist, and probably they spend some time in Sun Valley, but then their work doesn't stay there. So is there a sense in which artists kind of establish some kind of connection with the museum through their work, even if it doesn't live there afterward?
Yeah, absolutely. So the artwork returns to the artist. We have done some big outdoor installations that have remained on site, you know, semi-permanently. But yes, in general, the artwork returns to the artist, and then they can use it in whatever way they want. They can sell it, they can show it again. I have seen artists, sometimes it becomes the work they do here gets expanded in new ways. Uh-huh. So for instance, we worked with this wonderful photographer named Bin Don, who's based in the Bay Area. And Bin is Vietnamese American, was born in Vietnam and moved here with his family as a child. And he had taken some photos, he works a lot with historical photographic methods that are appropriate to the time period of whatever he's working on. Ooh. So he had visited Yosemite and made these gorgeous photographs or daguerreotypes of Yosemite. Just, I mean, beautiful, as sort of an inquiry into what it is to be an American citizen and what it is to share an ownership of the national parks. Mm. When I saw these, we were working on a project here. I was working on it with our former artistic director, who's since retired, Kristen Poole, that coincided with the centennial of the National Park Service. And it was a collaboration with Craters of the Moon National Monument, which is a really strange and wonderful lava landscape that emerged over 16,000 years of eruptions, I guess. That's about an hour from here. It's like being on the moon. And I wrote to Bin and I said, you know, I saw these photographs and I'm wondering if you're interested in exploring national parks further. And he decided he was. So he came out here and he made beautiful daguerreotypes here, but then also portraits of some of the rangers who holding lava rocks like babies. He, you know, thinking about them as the custodians and caregivers to the park. And so since I've, you know, followed his career and since then, he's gone on to expand that body of work about national parks and national historic sites and places of conflict like Civil War battlegrounds that are now national parks. And it's just really, so it's interesting to see, like sometimes you know, something will happen here that will trigger a new mm-hmm. project.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been talking about bringing people to Ketchum, to Sun Valley. Do you work also with local artists? I mean, do you also have a program for sort of developing Idaho artists or elevating them?
Yeah, that is, you know, in the early days of the Sun Valley Center for the Arts, before we changed our name, a lot of the exhibitions did feature local and regional artists. I have included some local artists in our exhibitions, and in fact, they have done commissioned projects, interestingly. I did a show quite a few years ago. We used to own this big piece of property where we put storage containers that were painted orange, which was our logo color at the time, and we had 8 Idaho artists create temporary installations in them, which were fantastic. So we've done that. Our current show has worked by an artist based in Boise. I would say that Boise has developed a pretty interesting cultural scene in terms of artists who are making more idea-driven art. So I have worked with a number of artists from Boise over the years. And then this fall, for the first time in a really long time, we're going to have an open call juried show about Idaho rivers, actually. Yeah, which will be open to all Idaho artists. It'll be a short 2-week show in between two kind of longer runs. But I think it'll be a nice opportunity. I'm excited. We're having a juror choose the work for the show, and I'm excited for the opportunity to give local artists the opportunity to share their work in our space.
Yeah, that actually reminds me, obviously shows aren't all of the same length, but is there kind of an average of how long your shows are up?
Yeah, ours are usually up around 10 weeks. Okay. We do 4 to 5 shows a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, it does sometimes feel like I've just got one up and I'm already behind on the next.
Yeah, I bet. One thing that strikes me, Courtney, is that Ketchum is, and Sun Valley, they're resort towns at different times of year, actually, not just one season. So you have your people who live there year-round, you have people who are coming in all the time. How do you think about audience when the potential audience is kind of changing constantly?
Yeah, so because we do have visitors come in who have a lot of familiarity with contemporary art from, as you said, from all over the world. So I do try to work with artists who have national and sometimes international reputations, as well as artists who are more emerging or regional in their careers. But I think that we try to serve our community first. Mm. All the time. They're sort of at the forefront of what we do. We have a really strong school tour program. And so I'll actually think about exhibition schedules in terms of what schools or what teachers, what grades might be interested in an idea at a certain time. I did a show about mining, and that was because of where we are, kids in this valley in fourth grade learn about mining. And the geology show, I did a show about geology that it was so fun. It was a great show. But, I mean, their artists did great things for that show, including an artist who had a model train running through the gallery carrying little sculptures of geological specimens.
Wow.
So we think about this place and how we can best serve this community. We're increasingly working with artists who can come here to do outreach to the community for people of all ages. And we're going to places that are not ours to do workshops and things to try and meet the community where they are. We have a pretty large Latinx, just about 30% of our valley is Latinx. Our object labels are always available in Spanish. Mm-hmm. All the didactic materials are in Spanish. Gallery guides are available in Spanish. We do a lot of bilingual programming. And that we're growing that. We're really trying to make that a stronger part of who we are and what we do, even if that often means going outside the walls of our museum.
Yeah, yeah. So what's the most challenging aspect of curation?
I think the most challenging thing about curating is finding work that your visitors will respond to and will take the time. I think every exhibition that I curate, I try to make sure there's work that anybody with any level of familiarity with contemporary art will understand. Mm-hmm. They'll come in, they'll see it, and they'll think, oh, I understand that. But there's always going to be work that's more conceptual mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. And so it's striking that balance, I think, is really a challenge. And also finding more conceptual work that people are willing to spend the time getting mm-hmm. to understand mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or willing to investigate at yeah. a deeper level. So yeah, I would say that's the biggest challenge that I face. Mm-hmm. And I don't always get it right, that's for sure.
What's your favorite museum or gallery, other, of course, than the Sun Valley Museum of Art?
So actually, my favorite museum is, I'm going to give you two answers. I hope that's okay. The first is the Detroit Institute of Arts, because that's the museum I grew up with. Mm. And it is the place that introduced me to art. My father, who's not particularly interested in visual art, he thought the Diego Rivera murals there were some of the most unbelievable things he'd ever seen. And so we'd mm. always spend time in the courtyard looking at the Rivera murals. And, you know, and then I went on to study Mexican mm-hmm. art. So mm-hmm. I think that's interesting. And I remember going to a Matisse cutout show there when I was probably 8 and coming home with my best friend, and we'd color paper and cut it up and make collages. And yeah, so that the Detroit Institute of Arts, I think they have just an amazing collection, and it's a home to me. Mm-hmm. And then the other is actually the National Anthropology Museum in Mexico City, mm-hmm. which is, you know, not, it's a museum of anthropology and not a fine art museum, but just the architecture of it and the way the objects are presented, the kind of the grandeur of it. Yeah, every time I go there, it just kind of takes my breath away.
Courtney Gilbert, this was so fascinating. Thank you so much for joining us on Working to talk about your fascinating creative process.
Thank you so much for having me. It was an enormous pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
When we come back, June and I will discuss the art of curation, the importance of questions and structure to any work of art, and June's ultimate love language, organizational schema. All that and more when we come back. June, what a wonderful interview. You know, I feel like, I don't want to get off on a rant here, but we live in a time where the word curation, much like the word creative, has been somewhat debased to the point where it now just means person who chooses stuff. Mm. And this was, I think, one of our first interviews with an actual factual curator, though not for lack of trying on our part. And I'm wondering if there's anything in here that particularly surprised you. What did you learn about the job and creative practice of being a curator from talking to a real life one?
Well, other than the mind-blowing breadth of the job, I mean, from coming up with exhibition ideas to hanging pieces of art, it was, I guess, the importance of place. As I mentioned, I first talked to her about the exhibition sightings, about human relations with extraterrestrial life. And that show came out of a regional phenomenon, an increase in UFO sightings during the pandemic in and around Idaho and that part of the world. And the exhibition involved artists from that geographical region. And in that exhibition, there were works that were inspired by specific places close to the Sun Valley Museum of Art. It wasn't restricted to that region. There were artists from all over the world in the show. But I was really fascinated by that focus on working with where you are. And as Courtney said, where appropriate, serving the community first. I think over the course of my career, I've had multiple jobs in independent community-based media, and yet I was reminded during this conversation that I have a tendency to assume that all the good stuff comes out of the big establishment mega centers, especially the New York and LA museums and galleries. And that is obviously an erroneous assumption. And I think my conversation with Courtney, as well as all the details of how she keeps track of what's going on in the world of art, it was really that focus on the local that it was just really good to be reminded of that.
I loved this thing that she said about the elements of a good show, that regardless of topic or theme, it should. I'm just going to isolate these again because I think it's really important.
Yeah.
One, pose a question. Two, bring together a number of voices that provide different answers and ways of thinking about the subject, even if they don't agree.
Yep.
And three, tell a story. It seems to me like this is actually kind of true of any artistic experience that progresses through time,
yeah.
but it's especially true of writing.
Yeah.
You've got a central question, you've got a number of different points of view arranged in conversation around that question, and then you move through a story that moves you through those points of view. You know, those are really the fundamentals, you know, and it cuts through all over the place. And, you know, that question you have might not be political. It might not be spiritual. It could be formalistic. It could be an aesthetic one. Who knows? I am wondering if you ever thought about it this way, because, you know, when I think about your forthcoming book, which I hope you'll tell us about again, I think of it as sort of having this kind of journey. And so I'm just wondering about how you thought about arranging the different voices within it to comment on its themes and questions.
Oh, I wish I could say that I had experienced that insight before Courtney put it so well. I didn't, but I agree, Isaac. It's really foundational. And I intend to incorporate it into my thinking from now on. As we've discussed before, I think, unlike for you, structure is not one of my strengths. I find it hard to outline. I tend to find structure instinctively, which is really inefficient. However, I think it is both useful and important to have tests that you apply to your work. If you don't make that commitment, it's way too easy to get into an echo chamber where you're just telling one part of the story, where you're only sharing one perspective. As I was writing my book, which is called A Place of Our Own, Six Spaces That Shaped Queer Women's Culture, out from Seal Press, May 28th, I kept asking myself, who's telling this story? Who's being left out? What assumptions am I making? And one thing that was tricky is wanting to tell the history accurately and still hold myself to account, because I lived through a good chunk of that history that I'm telling. And so I didn't want to kind of let myself off the hook. So I wonder, Isaac, do you think it's enough just to say, be honest, don't let yourself or anyone else off the hook as you're kind of retelling something that happened, especially if, like the two of us, we're talking about things that yeah. happened, yes, in the past, but not that far in the past. I think that almost makes it even trickier in a weird way.
Oh, it totally makes it trickier, especially when you know that the people you're talking to or writing about are alive.
Yes.
And
yes.
that there's a good chance that they will read it and they might have opinions on it.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
I have certainly written pieces where people involved have then given comment to the press in other interviews about what they thought about the thing I wrote about them, sometimes positively, sometimes yeah. negatively. You know, that yeah. goes with the job.
Yeah.
I feel like, and I have a feeling you agree because we've talked about this a little bit off mic, that, you know, your duty as a writer is to the truth. It's
yes.
to the truth of the story. And yes. if you tell that in a way that is compassionate and humane and understanding, even as you have your judgments and your ideas and your opinions about what that truth is, you know, you've done your job. And as difficult and anxiety producing as it can be when someone says, hey, I think you misused me in that process or whatever,
yeah.
you know, they're not always right. They might just not like what you wrote. But if mm-hmm. what you wrote is the truth, then, you know, you wrote the truth and that's the job. I will say that those ideas that she brought up in her structure,
mm-hmm.
it's really helpful to have it codified like that. And yeah. while I don't think we talked about it in those terms, you know, when Dan Coyce and I wrote The World Only Spins Forward, which is a work of oral history, you are very specifically beginning with a question, going through multiple voices
yeah.
as they approach that question and ending up with a story. I mean, that's the entire thing.
Yeah.
But I think that's actually true of a lot of different other forms. It's not just the oral history or the curated gallery show. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree completely. And it's funny. It really is. That could be a guide to writing a piece. That could be something that you put up on your monitor and every year, like, am I, you know, meeting these goals? It really is genuinely a great structure for just about any, I was going to say nonfiction work, but maybe for anything.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, I think there's a way that you can look at a lot of Shakespeare plays as he has some central question about how society works. And then through the plot, we get all these different points of view on it, you know. Finally, I have you here as a co-host. It's been a while. I've missed you. And so I have to ask about organizational systems, your favorite subject. I love that you asked her about hers, because not only is it a great question about her incredibly complicated job, but it is also a very June Thomas question. I was like, I wouldn't have thought to ask that, but June thought to ask that. It's interesting to me that Courtney has moved from very organized, labeled physical folders, one assumes in a cabinet somewhere, you know, you can just go through them and find the thing, to intentionally disorganized, scraps of paper with notes on it all over a chaotic desk, and then back to a new kind of organization, which is Pinterest. It's a good reminder. There's no one-size-fits-all strategy. All three of those have their advantages. The first is very tangible, very well laid out. You know, it's there. It's physical. The second, which is, you know, sometimes my strategy, allows for sort of new associations and inspirations that you might struggle to find in a better organized system. Mm-hmm. And the third, of course, is very visual. You know, it's like a map almost of your inspirations. You use a bunch of different organizational strategies. Do you find they each have benefits and drawbacks for different projects? Or, you know, and I have to ask, would you ever consider just covering your desk in handwritten notes?
Oh, I wish you could see my desk right now, Isaac. It is covered. There's a lot of handwriting. There are a lot of notebooks, but they're all full of handwriting. I mean, I am definitely no stranger to chaos, as anyone who has ever stepped into an office I've worked in will know. I think I am so obsessed with organization and the endless attempt to impose it, because if I don't maintain that focus, if I don't think about it all the time, I just know that the organizational rewilding will occur. It's always just on the edge of my territory. So I'm not as methodical as you might think, but here's what I do know. I've been around the sun a few times, and I tell you, nothing reminds you of the need for a system. And I would say just about any system, really, as long as you stick to it, than spending literally days looking for that one fact or quotation or idea that you just know is on your bookshelf or in your notebook or maybe in some digital file somewhere, but that you just cannot put your hand on, when you have experienced that particular frustration. And Isaac, something tells me that you probably have, because I imagine that pretty much every writer, or really every organizer, has gone through that at some point. Chaos really loses its appeal. So tell me, chaos has gotten you down, right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, sometimes I have these dark moments. I mean, the worst is actually less the losing something, although that has happened a couple times. I mean, the most dramatic losing of things is computer crashing, right? But it's more the like little anxiety at the start of the workday that you're not 100% sure where the book you need is.
Oh, God.
But as you know, one of my New Year's resolutions this year said on this very show is to get better organized. And, you know, it's slow progress, I would say.
I'm so proud of you, Isaac.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's episode. If you enjoyed it, don't forget to follow our show on your podcast app and rate or review it if you get a chance. And yes, one last Slate Plus pitch. Go to slate.com/workingplus today. Get bonus segments of shows like this one, bonus full episodes of shows like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, complete access behind the paywall, and you will feel inducted into the society of the righteous who support what we do right here on Working.
Thank you so much to our guest, Courtney Gilbert, and to our producer, Cameron Drews, who only curates the best bits of our recording sessions. We'll be back next week with special guest host, Kristen Meinzer, who will be talking with magician Joshua Jay. Until then, get back to work.